And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, inspirational, and informative people directly to your earbuds, and today will be no exception. I'm going to be introducing, in just a few moments, the author of a book that I thoroughly enjoyed reading. It's a book titled, How Christianity Saves Civilization, the subtitle, And Must Do So Again. And the time is now. So this is a very timely book. You can find the book on the web at equip.org, available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. I want to start the podcast with a quote from this book that I found absolutely intoxicating. And in some ways, this quote sums up the book. Again, this is a quote from How Christianity Saves Civilization and Must Do So Again by James Papandrea and Mike Aquilina. And it is a rather unsettling quote from a Scottish law professor by the name of Alexander Fraser Tytler. And it was written in 1770 or thereabouts. So let me read this quote. You can find it in the book. And this book is full of terrific quotes like this. But Alexander Fraser Tytler writes, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largest from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates that promise the most benefits, and that from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over lousy fiscal policy." And then the quote goes on to say, followed by a dictatorship. "The average of the world's great civilizations before they decline has been 200 years. These nations have progressed in the sequence," and here's the sequence, "from bondage to spiritual faith, from faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, and then from selfishness to complacency, and from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependency, and from dependency back again to bondage." And Jim Papandrea, as one of the authors, observes that the United States is now over 200 years old. So the time frame is about right for the United States to be going through this sequence. And we appear to be at the point of transitioning from abundance to selfishness. So the question becomes, how do we avoid falling into complacency and apathy? So we're going to talk about all that and much, much more. Again, the book, How Christianity Saves Civilization and Must Do So Again. Jim Papandrea fits our mission statement of being interesting, informative, and inspirational. He's a teacher. He's an author. He's a speaker. He's a magician. And after graduating from the University of Minnesota with a bachelor's degree in music and the theater arts, he received an MDiv from Fuller Theological Seminary. So he's ecumenical, to say the least. And that with a concentration in youth ministry. He holds a PhD in history and theology of the early Christian church, which is something that I absolutely treasure. I think this is fabulous because we need to learn so much from the church when the church was young. But anyway, he has this PhD in history and theology of the early Christian church from Northwestern. And then he studied Roman history at the American Academy in Rome, Italy. And he's now a professor of history and historical theology. Now, I'm skipping over a lot of his credits to go to the fact that he is a published songwriter and, catch this, a professional musician. And then he's a well-published author as well, including the book that we're talking about today, How Christianity Saved Civilization and Must Do So Again. In this book, the authors say that many people in our time feel liberated to criticize the church, but this book will equip Christians to defend not only the faith once for all delivered to the saints, but the church today and forever. And one of the points, Jim, that you make in this book is that we must defend our mother. And our mother is the church. The church is the epicenter of the universe. The church is absolutely critical to Christianity. Saint Cyprian of Carthage said that no one can have God as his father without having the church as his mother, because it's in the church that we receive the sacraments that transform us from one glory to another. And it's in the church that we receive the very sacraments that give us the power to do precisely what this book is talking about, saving civilization. So what do you have to say for yourself?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to this conversation. It's great to be a part of it, and I really appreciate being here and talking with you. It's a great honor. You know, I think that one of the things that Mike and I first agreed on when we first met is, you know, this idea, and we're not the first people to observe this, but this idea that, you know, in a world where tolerance has become one of the highest virtues, there is still one acceptable intolerance left, which is the intolerance against traditional Christianity, against the Catholic Church. And, you know, I do get kind of annoyed with a lot of the church bashing that we hear. And, you know, there's a certain smugness in the culture, ironically, a certain self-righteousness when it comes to the ability or even the joy some people get out of criticizing the church, the history of the church, Christians in general, et cetera. You know, and this is nothing new. I mean, it goes back, I think, even, you know, in ancient times already, there were those who speculated that Christianity was the cause of all of the world's problems. And then, you know, you have even very sort of well-respected historians like Edward Gibbon, who, you know, basically wrote on the assumption that, you know, Christianity is the problem. And so when Mike Aquilina and I wrote this book, we wanted this book to say, no, Christianity is the solution to the problems. It is not the problem. And we feel very strongly about that. And so that's kind of what this book is all about.
Yeah, and it is a terrific book. Again, you can get your copy on the web at equip.org. One of the points that you make in this book, and it is insightful, is that we don't have to reimagine the church. What we have to do is learn from the church when the church was young. We can learn from the creeds. We can learn from the confessions. We can learn from the ecumenical councils. But the church has been the God-ordained instrument, the pillar and ground of truth, to pass the faith on from the earliest moments of the church to today. And so we can learn so much from documents like the Didache, so much from the Bible, so much from holy tradition, which has been passing on the faith everywhere, always, and to all.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that in our modern culture, there is a prevalent attitude toward kind of what I would call a revolution mentality, that change is always good, no matter what, that all change is always better than the status quo or better than, you know, tradition. And that, you know, this attitude that if you want to fix something, the only way to do it right is to, you know, burn it down to the ground and start over again. And, you know, all of those kinds of attitudes, I think, are simmering underneath a lot of what our contemporary culture assumes in terms of how to fix the world's problems. And, you know, what we want to get back to is, I think, a saner, more logical attitude that, you know, what has stood the test of time is what's going to fix our problems. You know, not burn it all down and start over again, but go back to the foundation and to what has stood the test of time. And for us, you know, both Mike Aquilina and I are students of the Church Fathers. The Church Fathers are those early bishops, theologians, catechists, and leaders of the early church who literally defined for us what Christianity is, what the Bible is, what the church is. And, you know, we need to go back to those sources to find the kind of wisdom that we need for the future. And, you know, that's kind of where we're coming from on this.
Yeah. And that's a point that you make again and again in the book. One of the points that I underscored when I was reading through the book for the third time was the issue of truth. You point out that we often have this conception that truth evolves over time, and therefore the truths that we hold dear today are better than the truths of yesteryear. And that is a rank myth and fallacy.
Oh, yeah. It's really a form of arrogance, which says that, you know, like somehow the people who live now are automatically smarter than the people who lived, you know, 2,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And I mean, that's just not true. You know, I defy the modern world to come up with, you know, anyone on the level of genius of an Augustine or an Aquinas or something. And I mean, sure, we have geniuses now too, but the point is that, you know, it is not the case that humanity evolves in some way that means that people are automatically smarter or more enlightened now just because we live later in time. That's just not true.
Yeah, elaborate on that a little bit, because I think that there's a dearth of knowledge with respect to history in general, and certainly with respect to church history. So you mentioned the brilliance of the Church Fathers. You don't really capture that if you never read the Church Fathers. When you do, precisely what you have just said is underscored. I have absolutely been mesmerized by the brilliance of a St. John Chrysostom or St. Basil, St. Gregory Nazianzus. There's so many of these fathers. When you start to read them, you go, my goodness, they're in a category that surpasses Aristotle and Plato. I mean, I don't agree with their worldviews, but they were brilliant men. But when you read the fathers, they're even more brilliant.
That's right. I completely agree. And, you know, part of the reason for that is that they're not relying only on their own brilliance, but they are relying on the Spirit of God to inspire them as well. And I mean, part of the brilliance of the Church Fathers is they knew what to receive from the likes of Plato and Aristotle, and they knew what to reject. They understood where some of the earlier philosophers had been right about the universe, and they understood where they had been wrong. And yeah, I mean, these Church Fathers, in many ways, they are better philosophers, and they're certainly better philosophers than so many of the modern philosophers on which, you know, our political theories and things are based. I mean, you know, the Church Fathers make these contemporary philosophers and modern era philosophers and Enlightenment philosophers make them look like, you know, a bunch of whiners. So, you know, it's it really is eye-opening to read the Church Fathers. And basically what we did in writing this book is we sort of took the wisdom of the Church Fathers and apply it to, you know, the situation we find ourselves in now.
I think one of the points that could be underscored as well in this regard is that we so often say that we love the Bible, but holy tradition has been very important in giving us a right way of understanding the Bible. So it's not necessarily an independent instance or a complementary source of faith, but it's a right way of understanding the faith once for all delivered to the saints. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. And, you know, as I teach my students, you know, you have the scriptures as revealed wisdom. You know, this is not truth that humans have made up from scratch, but that has somehow been revealed to us. The primary revelation of God, I think, is the incarnation itself, the very person of Jesus. And then the scriptures kind of help us understand who he is and what the incarnation was about. But then, to your point, we need tradition to help us interpret the scriptures. And in those branches of Christianity where they reject tradition, they may claim that scripture is sort of, you know, self-evident, or that it can be interpreted and read by anyone, or that the meaning is plain and on the surface. But, you know, what ends up happening is they disagree and they split. And now there's like, you know, 40,000 different, you know, Protestant denominations, which is sort of proof that scripture is not necessarily self-evident and easily interpreted. And so we need the tradition of the church, which is, you know, the consensus over time of how to read the scriptures, how to understand them, what the meanings are, how to interpret them. We need that. And I mean, the bottom line is this, you know, that all heresy is really the result of trying to interpret the scriptures apart from the church and apart from tradition. And it is exactly the tradition and the teaching office of the church that gives us the checks and balances we need to understand the Bible, and that prevents us from, you know, going off on some tangent that would lead us astray.
And developing our own new tradition, and as you have pointed out, in thousands of different ways, and then in thousands of different organizations. Why were Christians so hated in the early Roman Empire? And the reason I want to start out with that question as a focal point is because from your perspective, you don't want to necessarily equate or make equivalency between the Roman Empire and what's going on in America today, as much as you want to highlight the pre-Christian civilization, the pre-Christian world, and the post-Christian world, and to see how the pre-Christian world was able to impact the Roman Empire in the same way that the post-Christian world ought to be able to impact the world today.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are definitely similarities between, you know, our context in the United States, North America, and the Roman Empire, but that's not really what the book is about. The first time Mike Aquilina and I met each other, we were both at a conference and we started talking, and we got around to this idea that, boy, you know, the world we live in now, in many ways, has come full circle to the way the world was when Christianity was persecuted. So when we talk about a pre-Christian world, I don't mean pre-Christian as in before Christianity existed. I mean pre-Christian as in before Christianity converted the world, the Roman Empire. And in that pre-Christian world, you know, this was a world where sex and violence and humiliation were entertainment. It was a world where marriage was a business contract, and people felt perfectly justified in finding love outside of the marriage. This is a world where prostitution and pornography were a perfectly acceptable part of the culture. And this is a world where people were disposable because people were owned by other people, not just slaves, but women were treated as though they were owned by the men in their household, and children could be killed simply because a father didn't want them. So this is the world that the church comes into. And to answer your question, why was the church so hated by this world? It was hated by this world because it showed the world a better way. The church came in and just by its very existence critiqued the values of the Roman Empire. And that was seen as, well, just downright unpatriotic and unenlightened and unliberated and all of these things. And of course, you know, spoiler alert, eventually the church converted that empire. But now we find ourselves in, you know, what many have called a post-Christian world, meaning that, you know, we've kind of come full circle, and we now live in a world that marginalizes or even persecutes faithful traditional Christianity, because once again, it holds up a mirror to the culture and critiques it and offers a better way, but it's a way that would ask people to limit their behavior, and people don't want to limit their behavior. And so here we are again in this post-Christian world where in some places the church is persecuted In other places, it is marginalized or called politically incorrect or called unenlightened or whatever it is. And here we find ourselves again. So, you know, Mike and I were just sort of remarking about how we really sort of recognize the world we live in as very similar to the world we read about when we read the church fathers in the time before Christianity was legalized. And we thought, we need to write a book about this. And so we did.
And a great book. Again, this book, How Christianity Saves Civilization, is a must read. It is on the web at equip.org, available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. One of my favorite apostolic fathers is Ignatius of Antioch. And you quote him in the book, and here's the quote. It's very short. It's actually memorable, worth memorizing. Christianity is greatest when it is hated by the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that, you know, what he means there is that Christianity is meant to be countercultural. And while it was nice for a while when we could assume that the culture was basically Christian, at least in our context, you know, those days are kind of over. And if we let the culture convert the church, then we're not being the church, you know. So the church was originally meant to be countercultural. And now here we are, we find ourselves in a world where, once again, if we're going to be the church, if we're going to be faithful Christians, we need to be countercultural.
You talk about Constantine, and I want to get into that a little later on in the podcast. But under Constantine, you had the Edict of Milan in 313. You had freedom of religion as a result of Constantine. A lot of myths surround him, by the way, and he has often gotten a bad rap, particularly in evangelical Protestant circles. But what's interesting when you read this book, this wonderful book that you've written, is that within the context of the book, you go very, very quickly from what Constantine did with respect to liberty of religion to what happened after his death with his brothers and then ultimately his cousin, I guess, Julian the Apostate, how Christianity was quickly persecuted again. But it seemed like from the church itself, from within, because Julian the Apostate, he went to school with Basil, St. Basil, he went to school with Gregory Nazianzus. He seemed to be a Christian. And in many ways, we have a parallel, as you point out in the book, in today's culture. We have people in the government that seem to embrace Roman Catholicism, but yet are in many ways more interested in a great awakening than a great awakening.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot going on there. I mean, it's so ironic to me that, you know, especially in the Protestant world, I think one of the greatest American pastimes is criticizing Constantine as the worst thing that ever happened to the church and propagating all of these myths about him. Of course, for the Eastern Church, he's a saint, right? But I think, you know, probably the most ironic myth about Constantine is that he somehow created this terrible marriage of church and state that we then in the United States had to get rid of. And, you know, the truth is actually the opposite, because before Constantine, there really had never been a culture that didn't have what we would call church and state, religion and government, in this sort of symbiotic relationship. I mean, just read the Old Testament and you see that. And yet what Constantine did was he was actually the one who invented the concept of, you know, what we would call the separation of church and state. And he invented religious freedom because he basically said, look, you know, we need to let everyone worship according to their conscience. And so it's just so ironic that he's the one who gets sort of blamed for any problems that have to do with this integration of church and state. He's the one who tried this great experiment of freedom of religion. But as you say, he really did not leave the empire in a state where it could be sustained. And part of the reason was, I think, that whether or not our churches may or may not consider Constantine a saint, there are things he did to become the emperor that we probably wouldn't consider holy acts. And then probably his son, I think, is most responsible for killing members of his own family so that when Constantine died, you know, his sons wanted to be the emperors. They made sure that a lot of their other relatives were murdered so they wouldn't be in competition for the throne. Well, those other relatives who got murdered were the more immediate family of Julian the Apostate, which is why Julian rejects Christianity. So, I mean, in some ways, it might be a cautionary tale for us. If we don't want the people around us to reject Christianity, we have to try to act like good Christians. But, you know, politics, it's a mixed bag, and it's a very complicated story of what was going on behind the scenes there.
Yeah. I mean, your book gets into Constantine and the bad rap that he has. And I actually made a little outline of some of the things that you point out in terms of what he did for the church. He paid reparations to the church. He outlawed crucifixion because of an emphasis on human dignity. Mm-hmm. He guaranteed freedom of religion, as we've already talked about. He envisioned separation of religion and government. And he counseled Christians to evangelize pagans as opposed to forcing pagans to convert. So he had a high stake in free will.
That's right. In fact, it's even right in the Edict of Milan that he was responsible for. It even says in there something to the effect that, you know, we're not going to force anyone to convert because a forced conversion is not a real conversion. Conversion has to be done by free will. And again, it's so ironic that people will propagate these myths about Constantine that he forced people to convert to Christianity. He absolutely did not do that. That sort of thing comes later with the likes of Charlemagne and stuff. But Constantine did not force people to convert to Christianity. He did gradually more and more privilege the church. And as you say, he gave the church reparations, and he's responsible for commissioning and building the first major basilica churches, like in Rome and Jerusalem. So he did those things. And, you know, unfortunately, he becomes sort of the villain in a lot of people's version of the story.
You explode a lot of myths in this book, and that's one of the intriguing parts of how Christianity saved civilization. One of the myths is that religious freedom was invented by America's founding fathers. You say, no, it wasn't an American experiment. It was a Constantinian experiment.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, it's too bad that the succession of emperors after Constantine wasn't more stable, because it might have lasted, but it didn't. And of course, one of the other myths about Constantine is that he made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. He did not do that, but it wasn't long after him when that was done. That was done by the Emperor Theodosius in the year 380 with another edict. So it wasn't until later in the fourth century that Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. And so that time between Constantine and, let's say, Theodosius was a time of a lot of drama, upheaval, and political wrangling. And it finally settled with, you know, back to that sort of marriage of church and state. But at this point, the religion was Christianity.
You're in this book talking about revolution. You want revolution, but these are revolutions that are impactful, transformative. The first of the revolutions that you talk about in the book is a revolution of the person. And this revolution, in essence, governs all the other revolutions that you talk about in how Christianity saved civilization.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we use the term revolution, we're being a little bit, I don't know, ironic or something, because in one sense, you know, we're fighting against this idea that what the world needs now is revolution, because we're saying, you know, what the world needs now is going back to the anchor of tradition. But in the time of the early church, what Christianity did was a revolution in its context in the Roman Empire. So, for example, you know, we talk about seven revolutions in that world, and they kind of start at the individual level and work outward from there in concentric circles. But the revolution of the individual was this idea of human dignity. You know, we have this idea that the idea that all people are created equal, that that's somehow self-evident. Well, in fact, it wasn't. And it was the Christian church that invented and promoted the idea that all people are created equal. Now, to be fair, it comes from Judaism and from the idea that, you know, we are all created in the image of God. But the very idea of human dignity, human rights, the right to live at all and to exist, the idea that all people born into the world, all people conceived in the world are created equal, the idea that the 99% do not exist simply for the entertainment or service of the 1%, right? All of these ideas were a contribution of Christianity to the world.
You make a statement just a moment ago. You said, to be fair. This actually predates Christianity, goes back to Judaism. I think that's a point worth elaborating on, especially with your competency in history. The church was never really meant to be innovative. It was meant to perpetuate. So the church is perpetuating the principles in Judaism. There are types and antitypes. I mean, obviously, Passover is supplanted by Pascha, reason being that Jesus's blood is better than the blood of bulls and goats because Jesus is the substance that fulfills the type of shadow. Talk a little bit about perpetuation as opposed to innovation.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the coming of Jesus Christ in the incarnation and then his establishment of the Christian church was on some level meant to be a fulfillment of a religion that already existed, right? Judaism. And so I think that, you know, in that sense, it was meant to fulfill. But there are ways in which it takes the religion of God to the world. In other words, Hebrew religion, you know, is the foundation of Christianity, but Hebrew religion was a religion in which God told the people to kind of be separate from the world, you know, and almost sort of isolate themselves or circle the wagons, right? Christianity says, go out and convert the world. And so, you know, in that sense, and of course, we can talk about, you know, a lot of Jesus's parables and stuff have to do with him saying, okay, now, you know, there's these chosen people, but now we're going to be welcoming in everybody else too, right? Now the gospel is going out to the Gentiles. And so I think there is a sense in which, you know, Christianity is about taking what a small group of people received and offering it to the world.
I mean, and precisely what St. Paul said, right, in Galatians chapter 3, that in Christ there's no Jew or Gentile, there's no slave or free, there's no male or female. If you are in Christ, then you are the seed of Abraham and an heir according to the promise. So the point you make, I think, is profound and important. We are called not to isolate, but we are called to permeate our communities. And I thought a strategic point you made in the book was we ought to be working within our community because evangelism works best when you are evangelizing your community, your neighbors, your loved ones, your friends, where you already have relationships. So rather than driving a long way to find a church somewhere, find a church in your community so through the church you can transform the community.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of what we're saying in the must do so again part of the book. In other words, the book ends with a chapter kind of like a Christian's to-do list for the 21st century, right? And, you know, the first thing is to notice that there are things to do. In other words, it's not a passive kind of thing. It's not about isolationism. It's about getting involved, getting out there. For those who choose to be on social media, it's about being vocal on social media and defending the church and defending our heritage. And, you know, I completely agree with you. It's about getting involved in a parish or church that's in your community and in your neighborhood. You know, the early church did not convert the Roman Empire by, you know, shouting with a megaphone the doctrine of the Trinity and getting everybody to be convinced of, you know, the truth of the doctrine of the Trinity. The early church did not convert the Roman Empire, you know, with some letter writing campaign or some way of, you know, approaching people they'd never met. The early church converted the Roman Empire by loving one neighbor at a time. That's how they did it, you know, and that's what we need to do. We need to get back to that.
You mentioned the Trinity, and another insightful point you make in the book is that the Trinity was the greatest contribution that the church gave to the world. I mean, if you have a Unitarian God, that God is a God who is defective because that God cannot manifest the attribute of love. So apart from the world, God would not be a God of love. And yet a Trinitarian God can have loving relationships within the Godhead, the Father loving the Son loving the Holy Spirit loving the Father and Son and so forth. So the very notion of a Trinitarian God, as you, again, so beautifully outline in the book, is the greatest contribution the church can ever make to the world, past, present, or future.
Yeah, you know, I think so. And I think, you know, one of the greatest truths there is in the universe is those three little words, God is love, right? But God is love without being needy. And to your point, a Unitarian conception of God is a God who needs people to love him, or a God who needs a counterpart. The pagan gods were all a conception of a God who needs a spouse God in order to procreate or create. The real God, our God, is a God who, on the one hand, has no need, no lack, no want, and therefore is all sufficient. But on the other hand, that means that this is the God who can overcome suffering, who can help us, who can do things, who can intervene, who can intercede. So, yeah, I mean, of course, you know this, no surprise here. I fully believe in the Trinity and in the Trinitarian understanding of God. And I think everything, even within Judaism, everything was pointing to this. Jesus came and pointed to it. And this is one of the greatest contributions of Christianity to the world, this idea that, you know, that not only God is a Trinity, but God is love. And yeah, so I could go on and on.
Yeah, you could. And I'll tell you, reading you, listening to you, I don't mind you going on and on. The points you make are insightful and very compelling. Speaking of compelling, you make a compelling case that to deny the humanity of a preborn baby is tantamount to denying the humanity of Jesus in the womb of Mary. I thought that was incredible. Here's the exact quote. You say, "To deny the humanity of a preborn baby means denying the humanity of Jesus in the womb of Mary." You also argue that abortion is just another form of infanticide.
Yeah, and you know, it's, you know this, that if, when you read the church fathers, the church fathers understood this. And ironically, so did the Romans. In other words, even the Romans, who had no problem with abortion, they also had no problem with infanticide. In other words, if a baby was born and the father didn't want it, he could have that baby killed or exposed to the elements to die with no qualms and no repercussions. And so in a sense, what the Romans were saying is, it doesn't matter to us whether you kill the baby before it's born or after it's born. So even to the pagan Romans, infanticide and abortion are the same thing. Well, of course, the early Christians knew that too, but they opposed all infanticide, including abortion. And you see this in pretty much all of the early Christian documents, starting with the Didache, which you mentioned earlier, a very strong, what we would call pro-life, you know, conviction in the early church. And in fact, it's interesting because, you know, when Christians in the early centuries of the church had to explain themselves to the broader culture, to the pagan Romans, you know, a lot of times they would explain themselves based on differences in behavior. And they would say things like, "We share our food, but we don't share our wives." And, you know, these would be ways that they would make a contrast between Christians and non-Christians. And one of the things that they always said was, "We are people who do not kill our children. We do not abort. We do not expose our children. We are the people who rescue children and protect children. That's who we are."
Abortion, the watershed issue of our day, in your opinion?
It is definitely one of them. Yeah. I mean, for me personally, it is probably the number one concern in terms of social issues. And I would argue, this is just me, so, you know, I'm not speaking for Mike here necessarily or anybody else, but I would argue that if you were to put a date on the year that we really turned a corner in terms of like turning away from a Christian culture toward a post-Christian culture, I would argue that that would be 1973. When we saw the legalization of abortion in this country, that's when we turned that corner. That's just me.
Yep. Well, I think you make a great point. So many great points that I have personally garnered from your work and from listening to you. One of them is the insightful observation that widows and orphans are like the Holy Eucharist. I just got back from Southeast Asia a short while ago, and I had an opportunity to see just how denigrated widows are in certain cultures that still have remnants of widow burning, cultures in which, to this day, a widow is a cursed person, and so someone doesn't want to marry a widow. And so the widows are oftentimes not taken care of, and I had the opportunity to see and be involved in a mission that's building homes for widows because they're ostracized. And you make this incredible point that gave me chills when I read the book, the parallel between widows and orphans and the Holy Eucharist. And I was hoping in the podcast you could expand on that for our audience, because Christ makes a big point of this as well, caring for widows and the orphans. And this is emblematic of caring for the poor.
Well, yes, it is. And I think, if I remember right, the comment about the widows and orphans being like the Holy Eucharist, I can't take credit for that. I think that comes from one of the church fathers. And if I remember right, it might be John Chrysostom. But I mean, you know, you see this already in Judaism too, this idea of, you know, concern for the widow, the orphan, the, you know, the stranger in your midst. And this carries through to Christianity as well. And here's the bottom line. This idea that we ought to care for the vulnerable and for those who can't take care of themselves, it really flies in the face of the sort of, you know, pagan assumptions that there are certain people who are less valuable. There are certain people who are a burden on you or on society. There are certain people who exist for your benefit. There are certain people who have less of a right to exist. All of these kinds of things are assumptions that are built into Roman culture. And here comes Christianity, and the Christians say, no, right? We are going to take care of our widows. We are going to take care of our orphans. And the early church, of course, even had what we might call a lay order of widows whose ministry it was to pray. And they were supported by the church. And the church saw that as a valuable, worthwhile ministry and something worth giving alms to support the widows. The church also instituted very early forms of, you know, what we might call monastics. At the beginning, they were mostly women. So they had this thing called the Order of Virgins, which was a way that women, if they weren't married or for whatever reason, if they wanted to have an alternative to marriage, the church supported them as well. And so this is, of course, you know, an early version. Now we have our religious communities. And so it wasn't this attitude that, well, you know, a person has to sort of prove their right to exist by contributing, you know, in some way. It was the assumption that everyone has a right to exist. Everyone is equal. Every person is valuable. No one is expendable or disposable. And that was the church's conviction from the beginning. And, you know, it made the non-Christians look bad and they didn't like it, but it eventually converted the world.
If you're someone who has very little concept of history, you might well fall for the ruse that America invented slavery. But you point out that slavery was part and parcel of ancient civilizations and certainly was a predominating factor in the Roman Empire.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, of course, you know, you can't read the New Testament without noticing that, like, St. Paul, for example, talks about slavery and doesn't really critique it. And you might wonder why. Well, it's because even St. Paul can't envision a world without slavery, because slavery has been a part of, you know, pretty much every human culture. But eventually, the Christian church could envision a world without slavery. And by the third century, you get Christians saying, look, slavery is not compatible with our concept of humanity made in the image of God. We got to get rid of this. And, you know, eventually the church all but got rid of slavery before it came back again in the 16th or 15th century. You know,
Second revolution that you talk about in the book is a revolution of the home. And then in that context, you make the point that we've already sort of talked about, which is that the notion of family comes from the nature of God himself, comes from the nature of a triune God.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, like I was saying before, you know, the church valued children in a way that the culture didn't. So, you know, children are seen as a blessing, not a burden. And we know for a fact that in Roman culture, way more girls were killed after they were born than boys because the girls were seen as a burden. Then the church said no to this too. And the church saw its role in society as protecting children, girls, young boys who would be at the risk of abuse by older men in Roman culture, protecting women, protecting the family, protecting marriage as, you know, meant to be monogamous and even sacramental. You know, adultery was, you know, Mike likes to say adultery was the number one pastime in Rome. But it's really true that when you look at Roman laws, adultery is usually described as something a wife does by cheating on her husband, but a man can go out and hire a prostitute, or a man can go out and have sex with another woman. As long as she's not the wife of another man, he isn't doing anything wrong by Roman standards, right? And if she is the wife of another man, he's only doing something wrong because he's stealing something from the other man, right? He's not sinning against his own wife. So it's a completely different understanding of what marriage and family is. You know, if you think our culture has any kind of a history of valuing family, well, we got that from Christianity.
Yeah. The revolutions are, and again, you're using that in a not a strictly denotative way. You're using the word revolution in a connotative way in some sense. But you're talking about a third revolution as a revolution of work. And I want to zero in on that for just a moment, because in the Roman Empire, as you make plain, work was not an ideal. The ideal was to be free from work and have the slaves work for you. And so if you're working, you're really denigrating yourself. So Christianity comes into that culture, and St. Paul is a tent maker, and you have shoemakers, and you have people who are involved in using their hands and pointing out that work, in a sense, is sacramental.
Yeah, that's right. That there is a real dignity to labor. And, you know, it's so funny when you read the Roman documents, the way the Romans look down on anyone who has to work for a living. About the only occupation that they don't completely look down on is farming, I think. Like, oh, he's a farmer. Oh, well, then it's okay. But, you know, if anyone's in business, oh, they're just getting their hands dirty. You know, so, and of course, these are Roman documents written by wealthy men. But the desirable occupation, and, you know, see if this sounds familiar, the desirable occupation is to own things and draw an income from the things you own and not actually do any work for yourself. And I always laugh, you know, when they talk about, well, who should be a senator? Well, obviously, wealthy people should be senators because, you know, since they're wealthy, you know they can be trusted, right? That's the Roman logic there. But the other thing is, I think that there is a responsible use of money versus an irresponsible use of money. Money exists, and this is the church's conviction, that money exists as a way to share resources, not as a way to hoard resources. And I think that's a very important critique that the church had for the greater culture.
Yeah, and something that you underscore so beautifully in the book, if you think about the triple braided cord of prayer and fasting and almsgiving, the early church fathers oftentimes put the import on almsgiving above even prayer and fasting, because giving is good for the soul. It's not only good for the world, it's good for the soul, which endures for all eternity in a resurrected body.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, another way to think of it very simply is almsgiving helps two people, not just one, right? It helps the giver and it helps the receiver. And this is interesting too, because we can see the very early stages of the sacrament of confession and penance because it's connected with almsgiving. But yeah, I mean, from the very beginning in the early church documents, we see the importance of almsgiving as a penance or as a ministry, we might call it. And the interesting thing is that it's not as though there's some hope that if, you know, by enough almsgiving, we'll get rid of poverty. That's not really the goal. In the early church documents, the goal is that by giving alms, you are sharing your resources with those who are less fortunate, but they have a ministry too. And so it's their responsibility then to pray for you. So there's this really interesting symbiotic relationship between those who have and those who don't have. Those who receive the alms are meant to pray for those who give them.
One of the quotes in the book that I noted was, "The storehouses of heaven are the stomachs of the hungry."
Right.
Great quote. Or St. John Chrysostom said that, I don't know if that quote's in the book, but he said that the rich exist for the sake of the poor and the poor exist for the salvation of the rich. I want you to elaborate on a common phenomenon that we all run into now in the streets of America, fairly recent phenomenon in terms of its proliferation throughout the country. Whenever you come up to a stop sign or a stoplight, you see people panhandling. Some people are really good at it. They can act as though they have real serious maladies. There was a particular situation that took place where three or four of my family members were coming from church and they all gave money to the same person, and probably for the same reason. Whether it was authentic or not, I don't know. But I bring this up only for, well, to get your perspective, but also it seems to me that the church fathers often talked about, and certainly St. John Chrysostom did, talked about that it's not our responsibility to find out whether this need is genuine or not genuine. Our responsibility is just to give.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That is the consensus, I think, of the church fathers. And, you know, so in a general sense, I always try to approach someone who is begging for alms without any sort of judgmental, you know, like I try not to assume that poverty is the fault of the poor, that they're somehow lazy and that's why they're in that situation. I try not to assume that, you know, they have to use the money according to my values in order for me to give. There are ways, I think, to give that sort of would prevent a person from just, you know, buying alcohol with it or whatever. And so I have in the past made a point to carry, you know, like a $5 McDonald's gift card on me or something like that. And just, you can just hand that to the person. But I will say this, I really don't like what I call the left turn beggars. I don't like that because I feel like it's dangerous. I think somebody out there is going to cause an accident or get hit by a car or something. And I don't like it. And I say that even for when it's, you know, the firefighters out there collecting for muscular dystrophy or the Misericordia folks. I mean, these are all great, very worthy charities and I want to give to them, but not when I'm trying to turn left at a stoplight. I don't like it. So that's just me. But you're right. In general, if we are approached by someone who asks us for money, the church fathers would say, count that as God's voice asking you to give, and don't worry about what they do with it. That's on them, not on you.
Yeah, yeah. Another revolution, I think this is about the fourth revolution in the book, it's the revolution of religion. And this is an incredible chapter. It's chapter 5 in the book. And it's the revolutionary idea that God is love and that we can enter into the fellowship of the Holy Trinity. But it also underscores the absolute criticality of the church. You mentioned earlier that it has become a blood sport to criticize the church or to say that the church has to become more relevant. We have to revitalize the church or rejigger the church or whatever adjective you want to use there. But you're talking about the church as the epicenter of the universe. We did touch on this before, but I think it's so important, particularly in that you have a chapter devoted to it, to talk about the criticality of the church and the church properly understood, because there are so many counterfeits of the church where you lose the sacramental life of the church. I often tell the story about speaking at a megachurch before I converted to Orthodox Christianity. And I remember the pastor who was introducing me saying all kinds of very nice things about me, and said, when Hank gets done speaking, by the way, there's some grape juice and crackers in the back of the church. Grab some on the way out. And so you miss the liturgical, the sacramental life of the church, which is something that is rather recent in terms of a phenomenon. I mean, it was not that way for the first 1,000 years or even the first 1,500 years of church history.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, the very fact of schism, the splitting or factioning of the church, is a huge problem. And I mean, the reason for that is because the church, by its very nature, is meant to be universal. The universal church. You mentioned the Galatians passage earlier. There is neither or no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, right? The idea is that everyone, the church is open to everyone. And the reason why this is such a revolution in the Roman world is because most religions in the ancient world, before Christianity came along, and even Judaism is one of them, most religions were specific to a certain kind of person. A certain ethnic group, a certain national group or tribe, or a certain occupation. Some religions were for the soldiers and the sailors, and some were for men only, and others were for women only. What's so radical about Christianity is that it's for everyone. And if you think about how Jesus set the precedent when he chose his 12 disciples, you have fishermen, you have zealots, you have a tax collector. I mean, imagine if you tried to start a Bible study today and you said, okay, well, we're going to invite Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Rush Limbaugh, Barack Obama. You know, we're going to like get all these people who normally should never be expected to sit down at the same table. And that's going to be our core, right? And that's what Jesus did. And he started something. And you know, we aren't always good at continuing this aspect of the church, but it is supposed to be for everyone and universal. And it is supposed to be a thing where rich and poor and everybody of every color can sit down at the same table. That table of the Eucharist is supposed to be a table of unity.
Elaborate on that a little bit. I was reading an article in our local newspaper, and they had listed actually LGBTQ-friendly churches. And they were making a dichotomy between those churches that are LGBTQ friendly and those which are not. So you're pointing out that people from all persuasions of life are welcome in the church. What are the limitations?
Well,
are there limitations from your
perspective? Yeah. I mean, I assume, I don't know this for sure, but I assume that when anyone talks about a church that is, you know, friendly to a particular demographic, fill in the blank, you know, what they mean by friendly is friendly on the terms of that demographic group. So in other words, if I don't know, I mean, you know, just hypothetically, if I am a thief, I'm a cat burglar, that's my occupation, and I want to join the church, and the pastor says to me, well, you know, we'd love to have you, but, you know, we're going to ask you to, you know, find a different occupation. Or maybe the pastor would say to me, you know, you're welcome here, but, you know, cat burglars aren't, you know, able to serve in leadership functions, right? So, or, you know, I mean, you get what I'm saying, right? So membership, attendance, even receiving the sacraments is one thing. Marriage is a sacrament in my tradition, so that's going to be an issue. But I think what we need to do is clarify that there is a difference between, you know, membership friendly and leadership friendly. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but you're also making this point in the book where the church is not to conform to the culture, it is to conform the culture to Christ. So, as you point out, It's one thing to say that you welcome all people, but you don't welcome a conformity to the culture. The church is a change agent in the culture. It's supposed to transform the culture. So it's counterculture in that sense.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, the welcome to membership is not an invitation necessarily for, you know, to use the language from before, reimagining the church or creating the kind of revolution that would be changing the tradition, I guess.
So you welcome someone that has had an abortion, but you never welcome the horror of abortion.
Right, absolutely. And I think in the welcoming of a person who's had an abortion, there's, I think, an assumption that, number one, that doesn't constitute condoning abortion. And number two, there's kind of an expectation of, let's not have any more abortions, right? At least ideally.
Yeah, again, the point is well laid out in the book. By the way, you mentioned your co-author a few times in this conversation. Tell me about Mike. I don't know anything about him.
Mike Aquilina, he is a fellow Italian like me. We bonded immediately over all things Italian.
Red wine?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Pasta. He's got a journalism background, and he is a very well-respected and well-loved speaker. He spends a lot more time than I do on the road, out speaking at conferences and parishes and things. And he's written, I don't know, 75 books. He's written a lot of books. And I'm just trying to catch up to him. But we met at a conference on the Church Fathers, and we've shared the stage a couple of times since then. It's different speaking gigs. And, you know, this was a great opportunity to be able to co-write a book. And I mean, I don't know if we'll co-write another one or not, but it was a great experience.
Yeah. Back to the revolutions, revolution of community, which is the fifth revolution. Maybe I want to start with the idea of forgiveness here. Let me recite the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Then deliver us from evil. And then what's so interesting is you don't have, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the... You have, for if you forgive those who sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their sins, your heavenly Father will not forgive your sins. So part of the revolution of community has to do with forgiveness.
I think it does, you know, and you know, Jesus told that parable of the unmerciful servant, right? Where in the parable, there's this servant who is granted so much mercy and then, you know, turns around and doesn't grant mercy and is therefore obviously criticized for that. And I think that, you know, in a sort of post-Protestant Reformation world where there's so much emphasis in certain branches of the church on a faith alone kind of Christianity, it's like that misses this whole thing that Jesus made forgiveness so important. Yeah, we have to have faith, we have to believe, but there are certain expectations that, you know, as James said, if you're going to have faith, you got to live that faith in certain ways. And it seems like Jesus, for him, the most important way to live your faith is by sort of paying it forward. All of the forgiveness that God has shown us, we should turn around and pay that forward and show forgiveness to other people. So I think that is just, you know, extremely important. And, you know, that is, in fact, one of the primary ways that we love our neighbor.
And also in this sense of revolution of community, you note what the early Christians did in terms of turning their residences, their hospitals, their monasteries, they turned them into places of service, where you could take care of the poor and the downtrodden, of the needy. And I'll tell you, Jim, I went through a 4-year battle with cancer, which I've talked about often on this podcast. And when I was on my hospital bed thinking that I probably wouldn't live because my percentages were pretty low of surviving after having a stem cell transplant and then getting an E. coli bacterium and going into a coma and all that, when I was recovering, I thought, and even before that, actually, but I was thinking so often, standing before God, giving an account of my life, have I done enough for the least of these? You know, and Jesus says that in Matthew chapter 25, If you've done this for one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. And this is a point that you get to over and over again in the book, that the early Christians really saw it as their duty to care for the least of these. And that was a big difference. That was a difference maker. That was what revolutionized the Roman Empire. The Christians did that because they did what the Roman system didn't do very well. And so often what we're trying to do today is secularize the welfare system instead of recognizing that this is something that we need to take the lead in as Christians.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, you know, if you lived in the Roman Empire back in the day, the way you knew when a plague was coming is when you saw your town's doctor pack up real quick and leave town, right? That's, I mean, you knew the plague was coming when the doctors left town. That's how doctors dealt with plague. And yet when the plagues came, the Christians stepped up and cared for the sick, even at the risk of their own lives. And, you know, and this applies also to the willingness of Christians to die for their faith as opposed to give up their faith. Why were they willing to risk their lives? Because they knew that what they had was something bigger than life, something that outlasts this life. And I mean, in a large part, that's what converted the Roman Empire. When the Romans saw them doing this and saying, wow, these people have a faith in something bigger than life, and they're willing to risk their lives to live that faith, that in itself was a revolution. But you're right. I mean, that was really the conviction of the church, that we all have a responsibility for each other, even those outside the church.
Yeah, a couple more revolutions, one of them being a revolution in death. And this follows on the heels of what you just said. The revolution in death was a recognition of resurrection, that ultimately, we are going to live forever, that we are going to live forever in resurrected bodies. And this revolution in death was multifaceted. So you didn't discard the bones of the saints or the bones of deceased Christians, because those bones had significance. We call them relics. They were touched by the Holy Spirit of God. And so this revolution in death ultimately hinges on the resurrection, which St. Paul says is of first importance. If Christ has not been raised from the dead, our faith is futile. Our preaching is useless. Then those also who have fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have faith, we are to be pitied more than all men. But Christ has risen from the dead. So resurrection is the central tenet that causes the revolution in death, a completely different way of viewing our life now because we see it from the perspective of eternity.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I have written a whole book, shorter book, on this very subject. It's called What Really Happens After We Die, about eternal life and the resurrection, and the way in which even our human bodies are an essential part of who we are as human beings. And so, you know, they're not to be discarded. They're not to be denigrated. They're not to be abused. And this is why the Christians have always had a respect for the body and a reverence for the body. And when people die, we treat the body with reverence and with respect. The Romans were so afraid of death as, you know, the final word, that they turned it into entertainment. Like, this is how they dealt with their fear, by mocking it and turning it into entertainment. And, you know, then you have the gladiator games and you have public executions and all of this stuff. And everything that we've been talking about made the early Christians sort of, you know, reject that way of thinking about life, death, and eternal life.
And this is one of the horrors from a Christian perspective, I suppose, of cremation. I mean, you might do it for ecological reasons or economic reasons and so forth. But from the perspective of Christianity, burial was the standard, because we know that this body that dies is the body that's going to be resurrected, that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the body that dies. But it doesn't mean that every atom is resuscitated in resurrection. I'm not making that point. But there's continuity between the body that is and the body that will be. And so for Christians, things like cremation In the early church, that was unthinkable. You don't burn the relics, you preserve them.
Yeah, that's right. The Romans cremated, Jews and Christians buried. And, you know, to your point exactly, that it's because of the belief in the resurrection. And of course, today the Catholic Church allows cremation, but what is not allowed is the spreading of ashes, right? And you see this in popular culture, you see it in movies, this idea of somebody spreading the ashes. And I think that really goes against, I mean, you're working against the resurrection when you do that. Not that God can't overcome it, but I think we need to take that seriously, that it is actually sort of disrespectful to spread or, you know, scatter the ashes. Because, you know, what God does is not scattering. What God does is gathering. And the body will be transformed, as you say, but it is the same body that will be raised. And, you know, this translates into the Eucharist too, because the body and blood of Christ that we receive in the Eucharist is his raised body and blood. And it's important for us to understand that too.
And it intermingles with our humanity. It interpenetrates our humanity. And another reason, a principal reason why our bodies are precious, they're not superfluous.
Yeah, that's right. And there was a heresy in the early church. We usually refer to it as Gnosticism now. But, you know, this idea, and you still see it now in some of these New Age cults and stuff, you see this idea that, well, you're a divine spark trapped in a human body, but the real goal is to be freed from the body, like being freed from a prison. And this idea that the body is meant to be discarded, or in science fiction that you can, you know, trade for another body or upload your mind, or all these things that sort of like diminish the human body. And that's not Christian, you know.
There's a lot that could be said about the seventh revolution that you write about, a revolution of the state. But one of the most important things that we have to underscore over and over again is that in the Roman Empire, for example, which was called a sexual paradise, people were not considered to be equal. And the average person was considered to be expendable. Christianity comes into that culture and says, no, every person is created in the image and designed to be conformed to the likeness, to become godlike, and therefore every human being has intrinsic worth.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it has implications for things like capital punishment. You know, execution was a spectator sport in the Roman Empire. And, you know, the church rejected that, opposed it. Eventually, the Emperor Constantine discontinued crucifixion as a form of capital punishment, but didn't get rid of capital punishment entirely. But I think we have to really think about that. And this idea that, you know, in the Roman Empire, if someone committed a crime, their death was considered sort of an object lesson to prevent other people from committing that same crime. It really wasn't about them or trying to rehabilitate them or anything like that. And so you know, that's a real concern, because I think we're coming full circle to maybe not, you know, maybe people wouldn't go so far as to say that, you know, some people are expendable, although, you know, the unborn certainly are treated as though they're expendable. But we're coming full circle to a kind of utilitarianism that defines the value of people according to, you know, what they contribute. And, you know, again, that is really something that, you know, the 1% sort of defines the value of the 99% based on, you know, their own greed. And that, you know, that's a big problem.
Yeah, expand on that a little bit, because you have in our culture, in our secular state culture, so to speak, a hierarchical system in a sense where you're looking at the members of Congress and the president oftentimes being served, as opposed to what was properly understood by the American form of government to be of service. And the same thing is true of the church. And the church is a hierarchical form of government, at least in the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. I was just in Istanbul. I had the opportunity to spend some time with the patriarch. And certainly you reverence the patriarch, but the patriarch actually is there to serve the needs of those that are considered in a secular perspective to be on the lowest rung of humanity. So the hierarchy of the church is not for the purpose of being served, but rather for the purpose of serving.
That's right. That's right. In fact, you know, I often have students come into my class and they expect me to tell them that the hierarchy of the church developed so that, you know, rich old men could, you know, hold on to their money and their power. And I say, no, the hierarchy of the church, this is another myth. The hierarchy of the church did not develop in imitation of any political or military hierarchy. The hierarchy of the church developed precisely as a continuation of the apprenticeship model that Jesus himself started by calling his disciples, and they chose their disciples. And it's this model of teacher and student. So, you know, your patriarch is the student of the previous patriarch, going all the way back to Jesus, right? And so this is why we have a hierarchy. It is, to your point, so that there is a structure for the church to care for the less fortunate. It is also so that there's a structure for the church to pass on the teachings from one generation to the next. But again, you know, as you indicated, in government, we have a situation where people who are supposed to be the servants of the people are now in a position to make the people serve them. And, you know, at least the Romans had one thing right, and that is that being a senator in Rome didn't come with a paycheck. It was a volunteer position. But the downside of that is you had to be rich in order to have the free time to put in the time. So there's that. But, you know, we have a situation now, at least in our country, where not only do the politicians' jobs come with big paychecks, they also come with the ability to vote themselves bigger paychecks. So
well said.
There's some room for improvement there.
Another marvelous quote from your book, let me read this. It's on page 194, 195, short quote, but a very poignant, profound quote. By now, it should be clear, and perhaps it goes without saying, that the ideas that no one is expendable, that all people are created equal, that every life is sacred, and that everyone should be free to follow his conscience are not political ideas. They are Christian ideas. No culture has ever embodied these values before there was a Christian culture. I mean, that's an incredible statement. Prior to Christianity, no culture ever embodied these values.
That's right. And, you know, perhaps the thing that comes closest is the Jewish faith, you know, but again, they were kind of told to keep it to themselves in a way. And so, you know, with the coming of Christianity, we brought it to the world. That may sound like I'm claiming a lot for our faith, but I stand by it. I think it's true.
Yeah. You talk about the concept of separation of church and state as being misused today to inhibit the practice of faith. And I thought that one statement bears a little elaboration. It seems self-evident, but it isn't.
No, I mean, a lot of people today treat, you know, freedom of religion as though it means freedom from religion, as though a person can complain that there's too much religion in my face and I want to get rid of it, and that they somehow have a right not to be confronted with religion. And that is just nonsense. I mean, you know, the separation of church and state, even in this country, as it was conceived by our founding fathers, was meant to prevent the state from running the church, but it wasn't meant to keep religion out of government, right? So we just have to be clear about that.
And again, clarity is one of the great beauties of your book, How Christianity Saves Civilization. I do want to have a quick elaboration, if possible, on your very audacious statement that, in fact, it's the title of chapter 9, the church can change the world again. Well, if the church can change the world again, how in the world is that going to happen? Doesn't seem possible.
Well, I think it's going to happen by people getting involved in uncomfortable situations, people getting involved in places where they're going to be criticized, where the church is going to be bashed. So, you know, now I'm not on social media, so I completely respect anyone who's not on social media. But if you are on social media and you see people bashing the church, bashing our faith, people, you know, propagating those ridiculous myths about Constantine, or, you know, religion is supposed to be the cause of all wars and all of these ridiculous myths, well, you need to speak up. and you need to point out the truth, and you need to call out the myths, and then you need to get out and vote. You need to protest if you need to. I mean, you know, some of the amazing things that have been done and the progress that's been made in the pro-life movement is, well, I mean, it is a kind of a revolution. And, you know, we've got the possibility of some hopeful things on the horizon, but it, you know, it takes getting involved. And that's why I say that, you know, that last chapter is kind of a to-do list. You know, Christianity created civilization. Christianity saved civilization by preventing it from becoming barbaric. But we've lost a lot of ground. We've kind of lost our grip on civilization. I think we can get it back, but it's going to take work, and it's going to take, you know, going back to the church fathers and the early church and looking at the church when it was persecuted to see how they converted the empire that they found themselves in.
Yeah, those are two operative words that you use in the book, persecution and sacrifice. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So persecution is inextricably linked to sacrifice. We need to be willing to sacrifice and willing to endure persecution, not again conform so that we have a life of ease, but rather transform.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, we forget a couple of things, especially those of us who are, you know, in American culture. We forget, you know, number one, you know, God is more concerned with salvation than comfort. And number two, and I think this is where, you know, the so-called prosperity gospel has sort of infiltrated American culture so much. We often live as though we have a right not to suffer. And Jesus never said that. In fact, if anything, he said, get ready for the suffering. Right? If you're going to follow me, get ready for the suffering. So we can't go through life as though, you know, we somehow have a God-given right to always be comfortable.
A quick summary of some of the things that you say in chapter 10, and I'll just throw them out here quickly. I made a little list for myself before I came into the studio. The first in this list is something that I want you to elaborate on, if you would, for sure. But you say, reject isolationism, respect the value of every human life, reject the culture of celebrity and humiliation as entertainment, respect the humble, the laborer, the poor. Then the emphasis on giving, so I just wrote down, give, give, give. Reject the creation of a secular religion of the state. Reject the evolution of truth, as though truth is evolving and our truths today are more sophisticated than truths of the early church fathers, for example. Respect religious freedom. Reject defeatism. And respect your neighbors. So the first of those, incredibly important in terms of how you enunciate this and elaborate on this in the book, reject isolationism.
Yeah, you know, I can certainly understand the temptation to kind of circle the wagons. And, you know, there's been some really compelling things written about, you know, treating your home like a sort of domestic monastery and living in certain ways according to a kind of monastic rhythm of life. And there's a lot that I like about that. But the problem with that is that if we just circle the wagons and focus internally, it's only going to get worse on the outside. We're going to find ourselves only more persecuted as time goes on. And so if we want to push back against that, and if we want to, let's say, assert our rights to practice our faith, even in public, we need to practice our faith, even in public.
Yeah. Another really important point, one of the last few I want to emphasize in this podcast, is you're very relevant in this book with respect to technology. Technology, we're using technology right now, and it is a wonderful tool to equip people, to propagate the faith once for all, delivered to the saints. But you say technology should never be a substitute for community. And with COVID, you had the advent of Zoom services and churches recognizing, wow, this is a very cost-efficient way of doing church. Doesn't take a whole lot of money. And people thinking, wow, I don't have to go to church anymore. But church is an embodied experience.
Yeah, it is. It is. And of course, we wrote this book before COVID, and I didn't even know what Zoom was when I wrote the book. Now I do most of my teaching over Zoom. And so I'm grateful for the ability to do that. But I am skeptical of technology. As a general rule, my family laughs at me because I say, don't trust the robots. But I mean, you know, this thing about, you know, okay, well, we had to do church as best we could, you know, online with COVID. But I would definitely warn folks against falling into the idea that you can really do church at a distance. Well, I mean, first of all, you cannot receive the Eucharist online, right? You just can't. You can participate in some form of, you know, what they used to call ocular Eucharist adoration. You can do adoration that way, but you cannot receive the sacrament unless you're there to receive it or someone brings it to you. And I think that right there should warn us against, you know, accepting too much of technology as a substitute for actual embodied fellowship.
Another statement that I mentioned previously in the podcast, but something that I think bears elaboration at the end of this podcast, you, along with Mike, say in the book, defend the church, stick up for your mother. That's axiomatic for Christians.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's too easy when you hear someone bashing the church, when you hear someone, you know, with those myths that, oh, you know, like religion caused all these wars, somehow religion is the problem, Christianity is the problem. When you hear that, whether it's, you know, in a social situation or on social media, it's very easy to just sort of cringe back, right, and not speak up. But the problem with that is by doing that, it's like you're saying you believe it's true. And folks, it's not true. That stuff is not true. Christianity is not the problem. Christianity is the solution, and it always has been. And so if you read the book, you'll, you know, you get a lot of ammunition for sort of, you know, defending the faith. But even if not, I mean, speak up, defend the church, defend the faith. Don't let the smugs get away with their self-righteous, you know, myths that ultimately at the end of the day, they're just doing it to get themselves off the hook so they can sleep late on Sunday mornings.
Surprise the world, you say, with joy and generosity. I think we've talked about that some already, but I mean, the Christian life is a life of sacrifice. It may involve persecution, but ultimately joy is not dependent on happenings. Maybe happiness is dependent on happenings, but joy is an inner quality of our humanity that comes from having a relationship with the Christ who spoke and the universe leapt into existence.
I completely agree. Although, you know, it takes a bit of spiritual maturity to get to the point where you can be joyful in spite of difficult circumstances. And I would say that it takes more than just, you know, going to church on Sundays. It takes a personal devotional life of prayer as well. And so I would encourage people to, you know, step that up too, in order to get to that point where you can be a joyful Christian, because I mean, nobody wants to convert to Christianity if they think Christians are all depressed and everything. So we do want to be joyful Christians because that is attractive.
Yeah, my son David, who set up this podcast, gave me the last question. So he just handed it to me, and I thought this was a good way to end the podcast. You're a Catholic professor at a Protestant university.
Yeah.
And so David's question is, how can Christians best embrace unity to save civilization?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of unity, like Ignatius of Antioch. And I think we really do need to, you know, be proactive about getting involved in ecumenical dialogue and in like overt acts of unity, a week of Christian prayer for unity, all of these kinds of things. And for me to sort of answer the question, I think I would encourage everyone who can to look into the early church, look into what it was like when the church was still one. So before all the major schisms, which I'll say, for the sake of argument, the first major schism would be in the year 451. So go back before that. Look at the Nicene Creed for what we all should agree on in terms of belief. Look at the first three ecumenical councils for the ways in which the church came together, you know, in those early centuries, and seek out opportunities of fellowship with Christian brothers and sisters across denominational lines, you know, and across those lines of schism, and try to get to know them and, you know, expand your circle of friends in that way.
Yeah, it's easy to split the atom. It's difficult to combine atoms, hydrogen atoms, and have unlimited energy for everyone forever. But yeah, I mean, if we are unified, and we're not talking about compromising the essentials. In essentials, unity, non-essentials, liberty, all things charity. Right. Mere Christianity, as C.S. Lewis called it. I love your book, and I love this conversation. I mean, you're better than the billing, and that's quite a statement. I truly appreciate your insights, your scholarship, your wisdom, and your book, How Christianity Saves Civilization and Must Do So Again, co-authored with Mike Aquilina. James Papandrea, thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, and I'd love to do it again sometime.
Well, we'll do it. And again, our mission statement, which we have fulfilled today, is to bring interesting, informative, inspirational people directly to your earbuds. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, and we look forward with anticipation to the next one. That'll be coming up soon. Again, thanks so much, James, Jim, if I can call you Jim, for your scholarship and for the brilliance of this communication on Hank Unplugged. So long for now.